So, welcome to another talk on the third day of this meditation retreat. And usually the number three is a very lucky number. You have the three jewels, you have the three refuges. So today is a very lucky day. So things might happen today. If they don't, never mind, it's always tomorrow, number four, which is a very bad day because that's death in Chinese. But it may mean the death of your defilements or the death of the hindrances, which is what I'm supposed to be talking about today, about the five Nivaranas. And even the word Nivarana, it means like closing a door. It's obstructing a barrier, an obstacle, which means you can't find any progress in Yon's meditation. They say it is these five hindrances which block peace and stillness and which disempower one's wisdom. So the more those five hindrances are there, the more stupid you become. Not only that, it means that the experience of stillness, of peace, of joy, is blocked for you. And as some monks have pointed out, it's a very good remark, it's a very good thing to notice, that almost the essence of the Buddha's teachings, the practice in the sutras, is the practice of trying to find some path to overcome these five hindrances. These are the things we are supposed to abandon above all others. Not abandoning your sort of greed or your ill will or these other factors, because you can't really do that until you've overcome the hindrances. The hindrances are something which you can do, you're able to do. So we abandon the five hindrances first, and then we get into the samadhi, the stillness. Then we see things as they truly are. Then all the other big things can be abandoned. So the whole purpose and job of keeping precepts, of giving dana, of being restrained, of meditating, is to weaken those five hindrances until they can become temporarily suppressed, so you can get this incredible stillness and insight, so you can fully overcome these things once and for all. So the path of overcoming the five hindrances is basic, it's essential to the Buddha's path. It is really the practice. So as someone says, what meditation is the way of overcoming five hindrances. So if you have any goal at all, don't have a goal to be able to watch the breath. Don't have a goal to sort of see nimittas or jhanas. Have the goal to overcome these five hindrances. Then you really are on the coalface, as they say, of our practice. This is what you can do, what you're supposed to do. And all the other things come as a natural result of success in overcoming the five hindrances. So those five hindrances, there's five of them, and you can add a few extra afterwards. But the first one is this, sometimes in the sutras it's called Kamachanda, and about 40-45% of the time it's called Lokayabhija. Kamachanda, it does really mean like consent, interest, involvement, you know, with the five sense world. And the other one, Lokayabhija, many of you know that because it's the same word is used in part of the Satipatthana, where they say covetousness for the world. It literally means like desire for things. It means the wanting mind. And when you actually point out that other rendition of the first hindrance in the suttas, now there's two words which the Buddha used for that five hindrance, and this is the second one, Lokayabhija, you find it's much more useful for you. Because sometimes people think it's sensory desire, and yet you don't have sensory desire, certainly not after you've had a good breakfast. Maybe in the evening you have a few sensory desires to eat this and eat that, but after you've been sated with a good breakfast, you don't really have too much sensory desires, but you still have your wanting. And that is an important part of this meaning called Lokayabhija, is that wanting mind. Now this is the first hindrance for a point. It's one of the biggest of those hindrances to overcome. The ability to sit here and just want nothing. For about 2 or 3 years in my monastic career, that became my main meditation technique, was to sit down and just repeat the mantra to myself, no desire, no desire, no desire, no desire. And if ever I saw any type of desire, even a subtle desire, arising in my mind, I'd remember what I just said and I'd stop that desire. Any desire whatsoever, even noble desires, the desire for the mosquito to leave me alone, no desire, no desire, the desire to cough, leave it alone. I'd actually stop all these desires and you get incredibly peaceful. And didn't really quite understand what I was doing and why in those days, but now I know that when you really do this no desire, you're overcoming this hindrance. So you look at your meditation, and if you come across any barrier, any obstacle, you can ask yourself, what do I want? And if there is any wanting there at all, you'll find that is the barrier, your wanting. So sometimes when I'm meditating, if you come across any blockage, I ask that question, what do I want? And then I see that what I want is something very stupid, very unattainable, and counter to the purpose. I want nimitta. But I know if you want nimitta, you can never get nimittas. Nimittas arise when you overcome the wanting for long periods of time. It's the wanting which is a barrier to nimittas and jhanas. Every time you want something, you move yourself further away from stillness, not closer. So to me, wanting became like enemy number one. Just like the police in their cars have these pictures of their enemies, the one they really want to catch and capture. And so you have this picture in your mind of enemy number one of meditation, wanting. That is why, even in the Metta Sutta, you know, to be contented and easily satisfied means we don't want very much. Obviously, being a monk, you know, you sort of cultivate that not wanting to quite an extreme level. Often told that story about when I'd helped this man in Thailand and he wanted to show gratitude to me. So he knew the Vinaya. He knew he could not offer me any money. So what he did was write on a piece of paper, Rajan Brahm, I offer you the worth of 100 baht. What do you want for about 100 baht? I'm not going to give you the money, but you tell me what you want for about that amount and I'll buy it for you. It's called pawarana, or invitation. And that's allowable to do. But please never do that to me or any other monk or nun, because this is what happened to me. When he said, what do you need? What do you want? When he asked me, I didn't want anything. I was content. Yeah, I was doing without many things, but I was happy. And then when he said, what do you want for 100 baht? I started thinking, can't really say right now, and what do I want? And he got very impatient. And I came up with an idea. I said, look, you come back tomorrow. Tonight I'll take a piece of paper and write out a list. He thought, good idea. So he went away to do his business, and that evening I took out a piece of paper and a pencil and started writing what I want for 100 baht. And straight away I looked at the scrap of paper I think it was the back of a mosquito call wrapper, because we didn't have any paper, so I wrote down exercise book, you know, something to write on. And then I looked at the pencil I was using, that was pretty hopeless. So I said, you know, like a pen, not an expensive pen, not like a Parker or anything, just an ordinary big pen so I could actually write something. And it was just so dark, I was trying to write by a candlelight, and actually I'd run out of matches, so I wrote down matches. And then thinking of lights, I actually needed a new flashlight, because the old one was not working, and some batteries as well. And talking about, you know, using the flashlight, you know, you're walking through these jungle paths and there's so many snakes and centipedes and these little black ants called motlin. And you know, you could avoid the snakes and the centipedes, but these little ants, I mean, they stung you when they got onto you. You know, you literally jumped if they bit you. They're really painful. So I needed, you know, some shoes. You couldn't go barefoot when all these mottling were around. You know, they're much worse than any ants, much worse than bull ants, because they had some poison inside of them. So I wanted some sandals. And then as soon as I wrote sandals down, I realized 100 baht was not enough. And I had to sort of take something off the list. And you couldn't, I mean, these were all essentials. I mean, you were walking, you did need sandals. You know, you can't just write with this old pencil. You can hardly read your own handwriting. These became really essential. And then before I could take anything off, other ideas came in. Talk about writing, I didn't need some aerograms. I had a mother and family in England and they hadn't heard from me for a long time. I needed something to send to them. And soon, 1,000 baht wasn't enough. And just the list got longer and longer and longer until I realized what was going on. I took that piece of paper, scrunched it up and threw it away. When that man came the following morning, I said, don't you ever do that to me again. I don't care what you do with that 100 baht. You can burn it, you can sort of give it to sort of the dogs or just put it in a donation box, but don't do that to me again. Before you gave me that option of 100 baht to spend, I was totally content. But now you ask me what I wanted, and my needs became endless. And I realized what happens with such wanting. As soon as you get one want in the mind, you want something else, and then something else, and then something else, and then something else. And it's never enough. So it's best just to cut wanting straight away. I don't want anything. And then I became such a peaceful monk who wanted for nothing. I love that word, want for nothing, because that's an English word which means you have everything you ever want, ever need. They say millionaires want for nothing. Actually, they don't. They want sort of the stock market sort of prices to go up. But as a monk, you want for nothing. That's my goal, nothing. So that gives you a lot of peace in mind. So you get the physical materialism, you know, wanting a good meal, wanting a nice place to sleep at night, wanting the showers to work properly, they're too hot or they're too cold. You know, just we put so much effort into this place, but it always goes wrong, doesn't it? You can never get a perfect meditation retreat center. You know, if you turn on the aircon, you get the sound. If you turn off the sound, you get too hot or too cold. You can never get it just right. But if you ever notice, you can get almost there, but you can never quite get it. That's samsara, that's life. So the best thing to do is, give it all up. So it's not that hard to give up materialism in the world. But the hardest thing for you to give up is what we call spiritual materialism. You come on this retreat, and your partner, your friends, your relations are going to ask you, how did you go? What did you attain? And if you go back and say, I just slept for 9 days. The food was good. It was a nice view, but I just slept. What, you never meditated? Yeah, I never meditated. If you could do that, I will bow down to you. But you can't do that, can you? Why? Why is that? Why can't you just absolutely do nothing for this whole 9-day retreat? Because of guilt, because of pride, because of spiritual materialism. You want something at the end of this to show for your 9 days. Something, anything. Even if you say, well, I've got a little bit of peace. Or at least, you know, I survived. That's an achievement. But all of those things are just spiritual materialism, and you just want something. And that is the hindrance to meditation. So any blockage which you have over the next few days, just overcome that blockage by asking, what do I want? And identify this wanting, and you find out how stupid you are. The wanting is not made mindful. It's lurking in the background, like some thief, sort of hiding in the shadows of your mind, stealing away your progress in meditation. And you've got to identify that thief, that wanting. And an amazing thing will happen if you do identify that thief, that wanting. You just have to see it. Yeah, I want nimitta. You see it and you remember, that's stupid. Straight away, just by knowing it, it will weaken and usually vanish. And when I do that in my meditation, as soon as you identify the wanting, the hindrance, it vanishes immediately. And you just, whoosh, you go deeper into your meditation. It's as if there is like a dam has been breached and all the water flows, all the energy which is backed up, which should have taken you into deep meditation, is now released, and you flow into that deep meditation. You get a big jump into a deeper stage when you notice these hindrances. So your job in meditation is to be totally content, not want anything, nothing at all, just being here, just like a monk who has no means to get anything. There's no money, no credit card. They can't get anything anyway, so they just give up wanting. And if you can do that, you get very peaceful very quickly. So wanting, big hindrance. You can start the meditation. What do I want for this meditation? Nothing. I'm just to enter this meditation without any wants, without any goals, without any desires, not wanting anything at all. And keep that in your mind. If you go on some train of thought, you want something from that train of thought. That's why it keeps on going. If you have a train of thought and you say, I don't want anything, the train of thought has got no energy to keep on going. Any sort of train of thought, it runs on your wanting, on your involvement. Wanting this to continue, wanting to sort of get some pleasure or some meaning or some sort of resolution or some sort of insights from this train of thought. If you truly let go, don't want anything, the mind is peaceful. All wanting leads to a contrary goal. Because what do we really want? We want peace. We want happiness. We want a sense of unity. But all the wanting actually takes you in the opposite direction. Instead of wanting peace, let go of wanting, and then peace is right there in front of you. Instead of sort of desiring to actually to still the mind, stop all this wanting stillness, and then stillness is just right there. So wanting is the obstacle. That's why the Buddha pointed it out. That's why you should remember that. And in times you're getting crazy on this meditation retreat. You can't walk meditation, you can't sit meditation, you can't sleep, you've had so many cups of tea. You've got nothing else to do. And you get to this point of, all of your escapes have been tried and none of them works. All of your strategies of coping have been exhausted and you're still in a big mess. So when those things happen, it's a great thing. What do I want? And then you find you've been chasing something which is just a phantom, like a ghost, something which is unreal. So instead of wanting things, I just, no more wanting. It's okay to be like this. I'm not going to try and change anything. I'm just going to be crazy, tired, in pain. I don't want it to be different. I don't want it to be the same. All my wanting, I'm going to let go and abandon. And you do that and all the craziness disappears. All of the stress, which is all due for trying to get somewhere other than you already are. Stress is just trying to, stress is the tension between where you are and where you want to be. You don't want to be anywhere when all that wanting has disappeared. Every part, every atom of stress is totally eradicated in a moment, just like that. You don't want to be anywhere else. Stress is a tension between where you want to be and where you are. So be where you are. Then there can't be any stress. Being where you are means not wanting anything. So our job is to renounce. That's why we call this a path of renunciation. But people forget what they're supposed to be renouncing. They renounce the wrong thing. What we should be renouncing is just our will, our wanting, just to be. Remember that, because it makes meditation so simple. And happiness just comes. The next hindrance is ill will. And I'm in a very difficult position being the leader of a retreat. Because people tell me afterwards that during 9 days they have love-hate relationship with me. It doesn't matter who the teacher is, whoever that teacher is, you have a love-hate relationship. In the old days, you used to ring the bell. You know, after 1 hour sitting, I'd ring the bell. And sometimes people really hated me. They were sure I rang it after 65 minutes, not after the hour. They were sure when their knees were aching, when their head was really stuffed up, when they were in great pain and turmoil. Say, come on, Ajahn Brahm, ring the bell, ring the bell, ring the bell. And they were sure I rang the bell after 65 minutes, not 60 minutes. So they hated me. And at other times I had just a beautiful meditation. Things were going so peaceful and nice, and they were close to nimittas and jhanas. And then Ajahn Brahm, damn it. I was almost there and you rang that stupid bell. So sometimes they hated me for ringing the bell too early. So they had this hate relationship with me. And sometimes when they thought, oh, there's a long time to God, I rang it early. Or when they're having a good time and I rang it late, I said, oh, thank you, Ajahn Brahm. So you have the love-hate relationship sort of with the teacher. And some of the things I say, why do you have to keep on saying the same old story again, Ajahn Brahm? And why do you always have to do this and do that? It's very easy to hate other people because what you're doing, you're transferring your pain onto someone else. It's not my fault. If I tell bad jokes, I told you, there's no will inside. It's totally anatta, non-self. The only reason I tell bad jokes is because my father told me bad jokes. You know, he conditioned me, he brainwashed me. So that's actually why I tell the bad jokes. Here's one of the jokes my dad used to tell me. He's thinking about it. He came home one day and told me, it's this really sad news, that you know, some cousin of his in Liverpool had a motorbike accident and he lost his leg, had to have it amputated. But, you know, this was many years ago. You know what happens in hospitals sometimes? Cut off the wrong leg. Cut off the wrong leg. Oh, that's a tragedy. And, of course, as soon as they realized, they had to roll him back into the operating theater and, you know, cut the, you know, the damaged leg off because that was untenable. So he lost both his legs in a mistake. So as soon as he could, he sued the hospital. He took him to court, but he lost his case. Didn't have a leg to stand on. And that comes straight from my father. I remember him telling me that when I was about 10 or 11 years of age. So it's just conditioned. That's just who I am. Just like your husband. It's like who they are. Just like the air conditioner. That's what it is. It makes noises. Just like people. They snore. They cough. If they have somebody complain about the keys, I can't find my key now. That's what keys do. Keys. That's right, here we go. This is what keys do. They jingle. I never found a key yet which doesn't make a noise like that. If you can find a silent key, I think you make a fortune. That's what keys do. So don't hate people when they keep doing the keys. It's just nature, that's all. So when we understand what nature is, all our ill will disappears. Because ill will, it doesn't come from other people. No one, no thing can make you angry. Only you make yourself angry. Anger is never, ever anyone else's fault. It's your fault. So don't blame another person for your ill will. Don't say, that person sitting next to me, they always fart, they always burp, and just, can I find another place to sit? I know that some of you actually move. You know, I saw you move sitting in one place at the beginning of this retreat, and now you're moving in another place. That's probably the reason why, to get away from that person. So you don't have to always sit behind them. But whatever it is. This is just what people do. This is just what the body is like. So you don't have to let other people make you upset. It's just people being people. It's monks being monks. It's Ajahn Brahm being Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Wayama being Ajahn Wayama. the kangaroo being the kangaroo, the crow being the crow, the weather being the weather. So ill will is all when we, again, it's a sort of perverse form of wanting. When our wanting gets frustrated, when the world doesn't turn out the way we want it to turn out, when we always think it should be better, when our wisdom should tell us, no, this is just how that world is, we sort of get lost in ill will. And ill will is one of the great consumers of our mental energy. It takes up so much energy. When you have anger, you feel alive because you're consuming energy in a very, very wasteful way. Once the anger is finished, then you're so dull. You're so tired because all that energy which you've been using for anger is... So people who get angry a lot, they're the ones who actually have a lot of dullness. So I know the ones who are really angry because you're the ones who get very sleepy in the morning. I can find you out. And it's true because you get so negative and negative and negative and negative, and that just drains them of energy. You find people with positive states of mind, they're just not going to get angry about anybody. I'm never going to allow anyone or anything to control my happiness. Because I know I'm in total charge of my anger, my ill will. So I decide I don't want to be angry. You know, it's as simple as that. I refuse to allow anyone else's speech or actions to take away my happiness. So you start to own your mind in that particular sense, rather than giving your mind over to other people to control. It's a wonderful thing to know you can do that, which means you don't get angry anymore. Why should I allow stupid people to make me upset? Why should I allow people's cruelty to affect me? They're making the bad karma, not me. They deserve to suffer, not me. So I will never have ill will. And that way that the mind doesn't consume so much energy. When it doesn't consume so much energy, the dullness is basically mostly vanished. I think that's why the Buddha put those one and two at the head of the list of five hindrances. No wanting, no ill will. Also, you know, ill will is when we keep lingering on the past. Because somebody says something wrong, they only do it once. They only do it once, and they have some ill will, and they call you a stupid idiot. It's amazing just how many people, they call you an idiot once, and you keep on remembering it. That was the monk who called me an idiot. They called me an idiot. Every time you remember what they say, you allow them to call you an idiot one more time. Someone cheated and hurt you in business. Every time you remember that event, you're permitting them to hurt you another time. And if you think this person did it on purpose, and you keep remembering it, you're just playing into their game. So if someone has hurt you, if someone has acted badly, if they have mistreated you, abused you, lied about you, only allow them to hurt you once, if at all. And as soon as they said it, let it go. Don't keep it. You do that, first of all, by knowing, number one, you can. It's allowable, permissible to let pain of the past go. And number two, you realize it's actually beneficial to let it go. You don't have to keep things. And it's best you don't keep things which are painful from the past. If you do that, most of your will goes. Because of that, in the meditation practice, just being in the present moment, really being in this moment, is a highly effective way of overcoming those first two hindrances. Because all ill will is about something which happened in the past. All wanting is about something which might happen in the future. And so if you really focus in the present moment and do it to perfection, those two major hindrances are just cut off. Sometimes, in my own meditation, again, if the meditation isn't biting, if it's not getting peaceful and still, that's another technique which I use. I just remember present moment awareness. At any stage in the meditation, even at nimitta stage, if it's not sharp, if it's not going somewhere, I think present moment awareness. Because that present moment awareness, I find that my... It's like, you know, the focusing in your camera. The focus has just got a little bit blurred over the minutes. You just need to turn it slightly just to sharpen the focus so it's really in the present moment. So it's not even a little bit of the next moment, not even a tiny amount of the last moment. Totally focused. And that's sort of the image which I give myself of a camera lens. I've got like a nimitta or even just delightful breath coming up. And just tighten the focus so it's really sharp in the present moment. And that gives immense power to the meditation. The reason is because there's a slight bit of ill will, there's a slight bit of desire left. That's why I have present moment, that's why I have the future, a little bit of the past. The desire is thinking this is going to develop into a really lovely meditation soon. I'm wanting something in the next moment. So I've got to sharpen the focus, so it's right in the present moment, not even a smidgen of the future left. Or it may be it's taking too much time, in other words I'm looking at the past. I just tighten the focus so there's not even any memory of the last millisecond. And so by tightening my focus in the present moment, right, that's one great technique of overcoming those two hindrances. At one simple stroke. Right in the present moment. That's also why I emphasize present moment awareness at the beginning of the meditation. To really weaken those first two hindrances of wanting and ill will. And when you tighten it that sharp in the present moment, wow, those two hindrances, they can't survive. You're in this moment, and that's all you have. Remember, all wanting is about something which might happen in the future, some projection away from where you are now. And all will is some memory of some terrible thing, some failure, something you don't like in the past. Present moment awareness stops all of that. The next two hindrances of first one of sloth and torpor. Your favorite hindrance. It's my favorite hindrance as well because it's the one which if any of those hindrances should be taken off the list. Because that sloth and torpor is not really much of an enemy at all. For those of you who haven't got good memories, all you meditators are getting older every year. So I hope that you're forgetting all the stories which I keep on telling. The story of the Buddha and Ananda and the two monks. And the Buddha walking through the forest with his attendant Ananda and see this monk sitting perfectly straight, straight back, right hand over left hand, thumbs touching, his chin slightly tucked in, the eyes closed, absolutely still. Perfect posture. The sort of posture which would win the competition of posture of the year. And the Buddha turned around to Ananda and said, I'm worried about that monk. And a few weeks later, that monk had disrobed and got married. And deeper in the jungle, he saw another monk nodding backwards and forwards, his head bowed. Half asleep, hands all over the place. Just like when I open my eyes in the morning and see some of you guys. And the Buddha turned around to Ananda and smiled. I'm not worried about that monk. 2 weeks later, fully enlightened with all the psychic powers. So for those of you who had sloth and torpor this morning, I'm expecting a great deal from you. When I first read that story, it made no sense. Surely sloth and torpor is a hindrance, and the other monk was sitting really straight. But you understand, that first monk, sitting perfectly straight, was the control freak monk. And there was one monk I grew up with who was like that. He was this French monk. Now, he would sit meditation all night once a week, and you'd never see him droop his head. He was always perfect posture throughout the night. 3 o'clock in the morning, he'd be out there, perfect posture, never nodding once. And, you know, he never taught very much. We all thought that, you know, that was one of our star meditators. He's going to be really great. And if he's not sort of enlightened already, you know, he soon will be. He'll be one of these great masters for the Western world. And then while I was on retreat somewhere, he disrobed. And many of us, we were really shocked. You know, some monks disrobe, you expect it. You know, you wonder why they even last that long. But this man, he thought, gee, he sat so perfectly. And of course, once he said he was disrobed, that's when we all started talking to him. Why? And then he told this story, and it was almost made you cry. He said, for all these years, I was having to hold my body, and it hurt so much. I had to put so much effort in just to hold myself straight. And he said, sometimes in those early morning meditations, I'd open my eyes and see monks like Ajahn Brahm slipped all over the place. And I was so jealous. If only I could do that, he thought. If only I could let go enough just to have a moment of peace, even if it was sloth and torpor. And he was one of these excessive control freaks who could not let go at all. And there's even been many Anagarikas in Bodhinyana Monastery. I've met them after they've left. And they said the problem was that they were trying so hard to be the perfect Anagarika. And it was so much pain for them, they couldn't stand it any longer. Why do we always have to be the perfect person? Why in this meditation retreat do you have to be the perfect meditator? This is not a competition. We're not going to give you grades afterwards. I'm not going to publish these, the results of your interviews. And there's a tape recorder under that table, so... No, there isn't. Why do you have to try so hard? What are you trying to prove? Just spiritual materialism again, isn't it? So, the control freak, they're the ones which any meditation teacher is really worried about. So if I see people here never having sloth and torpor, I'll be very worried and concerned about you. If from time to time you get up early in the morning, you make a mistake, you get up too early and you're a bit sloppy, I think that person has got prospects. Because at least you're letting go. And I look back upon those times when I had sloth and torpor in Thailand. You look back on what was happening. You know, we'd get up 3 o'clock every morning, and I was very strict on that. I'd always get up 3 o'clock in the morning. I'd never sleep in. I think even when I was sick, I just got into the habit. I remember first time going to England, and there you'd only get up at 4 o'clock, but I couldn't help it. I always got up at 3 o'clock anyway. It was conditioned, brainwashed, if you like. So I'd always get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you didn't go to bed till 10 or 11 o'clock, sometimes later. So you only had about four and a half hours. I think 4.5 hours sleep was my limit. And that's not enough. I was sleep deprived. No, for months, for years. And number two, the climate in northeast Thailand. This was like a remnant of jungle, thick forest, hardly any air, hot, steamy. And I just was not used to that sort of climate. You know, I was made in England. I was used to snow and cold and drizzle. That's what my body was accustomed to. So straight away, my body didn't know what to do with this hot, steamy climate. And of course, third, you know, you were malnourished. If you saw a photo of me in those days, you wouldn't recognize me. I was just skin and bones. And it wasn't so because I was eating wisely, because, you know, you're just eating whatever you could and it still wasn't enough. So you were malnourished, sleep deprived, in a climate you weren't used to. Of course you got sleepy. What do you expect? I remember just going to Bangkok to do visas and we're staying in this temple. They had an air-conditioned room. And it was a revelation. You can get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and you meditate, you didn't feel sleepy. And it was amazing. It was just because the climate was no more comfortable for you. And so it became quite clear that it wasn't some sort of defect in me, it was just causes and conditions. But being a stupid monk, I used to try and fight that sloth and torpor. And I do have great amounts of willpower when I want to use it. And I use that willpower, fighting sloth and torpor, fighting it, doing battle with it. Most times you'd lose, but sometimes you'd win. You'd actually break through, and the tiredness would go. But every time you broke through sloth and torpor, all you had left was restlessness. You couldn't stop thinking. So calm down the rest of the calm, calm, calm. Then you fall asleep again. And it was really frustrating. You couldn't find this middle, you know, between restlessness and sloth and torpor. Either you're really dull or you couldn't stop thinking. Calm the thinking, you fell asleep. You know, force the sleep away and you were thinking. And it was only until I, you know, figured out this idea of the two halves of the mind, the doer and the knower. Ajahn Chah kept on talking about that, but you never got it. You know, so often you give these pieces of advice, you have to give them many, many times. Actually, I don't mind repeating myself because sometimes six or seven times before you get it. Ah, now I know what that means. The doer and the knower. I was doing so much. Doing, doing, fighting, fighting, controlling, controlling. That's why I lost whatever little energy I had. Then after a while, you just give up. Stop fighting sloth and torpor, just leave it alone. Because you don't fight it, you find the body starts to straighten. The mist starts to disappear. The energy starts coming. You're becoming more and more mindful. And when the mist clears, you're not restless. You're poised. Mindful and still, and mindfulness keeps on increasing. Why does that happen? Because I was not fighting the sloth and torpor. I wasn't wasting the little energy I had. I was preserving the energy. It was all flowing into mindfulness. Empowering it, making it stronger and stronger. Until the mindfulness became strong enough because of stillness, because of no fighting, because of making peace, being kind, being gentle. The energy was going back into the mind. And soon it was enough to totally dispel all the murkiness in the mind. Sloth and torpor vanished that way. And these days that's what I use. Sometimes I'm tired, because sometimes you don't sleep enough. Go traveling, go to different places. Sometimes people put you up in rooms, and it's Chinese New Year, like just recently in Kuala Lumpur. Managed to get back to the room about 11 p.m. and managed just to fall asleep. Bang, 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 bang. At midnight, Chinese New Year. That's really unfair. I want to get some rest. I've been working all day. Bang, 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 bang. For another half an hour, so welcome to New Year. They scared away the spirits, almost scared me away as well. So sometimes that happens. You can't stop that. That's just life. So, sometimes you're tired. But if I am tired, you're meditating, I just know exactly what to do. You're tired, I just make total peace with it. Sloth and torpor, the door of my heart's open to you. You exist too. No one loves you, but I love you. Everyone hates you, sloth and torpor. And I always like to stick up, you know, for the underdogs, like sloth and torpor and restlessness. So, okay, sloth and torpor, you can come and stay with me. When I'm so kind to that sloth and torpor, the sloth and torpor just vanishes. Because I don't fight it. I make peace, be kind, be gentle. It's wonderful to see. It just vanishes by itself naturally. And when it's vanished, because I've been making peace, being kind, being gentle, that's what's left. Not the dullness, but the beautiful peace. But now the mindfulness is getting stronger and stronger. Then you get some really nice meditations. So don't be afraid of sloth and torpor. You know, but most of it is just natural. However, if it's coming from boredom, now boredom is more like a sort of ill will rather than sort of sloth and torpor. It sort of straddles, you know, the hindrance of ill will and the hindrance of sloth and torpor. Because all boredom is, you know, you have ill will towards the present moment. You're not really interested in it. It's a rejection of this present moment. So the best way of overcoming boredom is just with a bit of kindness. Yeah, it's just boring. Here we go again. What are you going to do today? More meditation. Walking. Have you had enough already yet of walking and sitting, walking and sitting? Sitting and walking. Try to do something different. Instead of walking and sitting, try sitting and walking. It's just so boring in this place. Nothing to do. No sort of books to read. You can't even talk to each other. You can't just invite someone back to your room. Let's have a cup of coffee and talk about whatever. You can't do anything. Just stuck in this place for another 6 days. You're counting the time now. So sometimes life can be boring. But it's only because, you know, you don't like where you are. So as a monk, sometimes, you know, you think life can be so boring. But I put energy into what I'm doing. Sometimes, look at me, another talk. I've been giving a talk every day for about 4 weeks now. Another talk, another meditation retreat. How many more meditation retreats do I have to teach? Same people most of the time, same seat. I want someone new to... Boring. More like the morning chanting. Same old chant, so bugger why. Don't understand a word of what you're saying, but here we go again. But you notice me this morning, you just put some energy into it. You know, remember what I said this morning? A 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, this is what should be done. So make it interesting. Have fun. You can put fun into things, and then the boredom disappears. Because it's the ill will, the negativity creates that boredom. There's a lot of interest in anything you have to do, but the ill will refuses to see anything interest. Now you're, you know, too big for this. You want something better. So take away your ego, take away the ill will, and much of boredom will disappear. Alternatively, you can use investigation to overcome boredom. This boredom, what does it feel like? Where does it come? Is boredom exactly the same feeling every second, or does it change? Do you get to this peak of boredom and then it sort of disappears again? You know, this boredom, where is it felt in the body? And yet, does it sort of, you know, morph? You know, is this the most bored you ever felt in your life before? Or, you know, just sort of number two or number three in the scale? And just, now how deep is it? How dense is that boredom? Or is it sometimes something quite light? Make an investigation of boredom. And then you find boredom is the most interesting subject to investigate. It's fascinating investigating boredom. And then you find you're so interested in investigating this phenomena, you're not bored at all. That's another way of becoming bored. Just get into it, investigate it. So the other big hindrance is restlessness. You can't sit still. Walking never gets you anywhere. You can't get to sleep. You know, you sit here at 9:30, 10 o'clock, you ask your body, what do you want? It said, take me to bed. You take it to bed, you ask your body what it wants. I want to go back to the meditation hall, please. You get so sleepy in this hall, you're almost falling asleep, so you decide, oh, I'm going to follow Ajahn Brahm's advice and go to bed. And you lay down, you're wide awake. This crazy restless mind. So what should you do? All restlessness comes from a lack of contentment. A lack of wanting to be here. Always thinking that the next place will be somehow better. Let me tell you, the next moment will never be better than this one. This moment is as good as it gets. This is the best. This is the peak. Now. So when you invest all of your attention and energy into this moment, this will do for me. You are contented and easily satisfied, and all restlessness disappears. If you're happy to be here, then you never want to go anywhere else. And restlessness is always wanting to go somewhere else. Always think there's something wrong with this moment, something wrong with you. This moment has come into being according to many causes and conditions. It's perfect according to those causes and conditions. It's here. Make peace with it. Be content with it. Allow it to be. And all restlessness disappears. I got this simile a few years ago. If life is a journey, meditation is a seat on that journey where you can sit down and rest. Somehow, sometimes that seat in the middle of your journey is not the most comfortable place to sit down on. So when you stop on this journey, you sit down, the seat is made of stone. It's freezing cold and lumpy. Bits of that seat just protrude into your buttocks, causing you a lot of discomfort, and it's chilly and it's hard. It's not the best seat to sit down on, but it's the only one you've got, so you sit down on it. That's called this moment. So when you stop all this restlessness and you actually hear, this moment is not comfortable, it's not the best, there's always things which irritate you in this moment. But you continue sitting on that stone seat. And the longer you sit on it, the warmer it becomes. The longer you sit on it, the smoother it becomes. The longer you sit on it, the softer it becomes. And if you continue sitting on this in this simile, this stone seat, after about 15 minutes or half an hour, that stone seat is just so warm and comfortable. It's like one of these sofas specifically designed for you, with electronic heating underneath, just nice and soft. It becomes a perfect seat. The reason is, the quality of the seat has got nothing to do with the seat itself. It's just the quality of your wanting. It makes it hard. When you let go of that wanting, the seat, this present moment, gets softer and more beautiful and more easy, more joyful. So the restlessness is looking for a quiet, comfortable place to sit down. You never find it that way. You sit down right here, this moment, whatever this moment happens to be. You make peace, you're kind, you're gentle with this moment. And this moment turns into like the sofa. The longer you stay in this moment, the more beautiful and peaceful it becomes. That's its nature. The chair changes. The seat morphs into something very comfortable and pleasant. So try just resisting that restlessness. Not looking for comfort and peace somewhere else. Look for it in this very moment. It does help by knowing that all the stages of meditation are contained one within the next, one within the other. So, present moment is right in the middle of time. Silence is in the middle of the present moment. The breath is in the middle of the silence. The delightful breath is in the middle of the ordinary breath. The nimitta is in the middle of the delightful breath. The jhana, first jhana, is in the middle of the nimitta. Second jhana is in the middle of the first jhana, and so it goes. The next stage is right within the one you're in now. So you don't have to go on to the next moment. Or you don't have to go on to the next stage. You stay where you are, right in this moment. And you go into this moment. So you're sitting here, this ordinary moment, and it's the nature of the mind. If you're not restless, if you keep your attention in this moment, it gets into real present moment. You just stay in the present moment, it gets into silence. It happens naturally. You're in that silence and you're aware of the breath. It just happens automatically. You're in that sort of breath and the delightful breath is there. You haven't chosen it. You haven't gone somewhere else to look for the delightful breath. It's just the ordinary breath has morphed into the delightful breath. You don't sort of say, now I should go on to nimitta. You don't move away from your object. That's restlessness if you move away from the object. You stay where you are. You get more fully into wherever you happen to be. All meditation is being more fully where you already are. More deeply into where you already are. You don't go anywhere else. Right in the middle of that delightful breath, this nimitta just comes out. Just like a flower comes out of a bud. A And then just watching that nimitta, and then just it envelops you or fall into it. It's in the middle of that nimitta. That's where you find the jhana. So you never actually reject any part of your meditation. You never sort of throw anything away. This moment right now, and the one you're in right now, all the jhanas are right in this very moment. You're listening to me in the middle of all this experience is a jhana. Just it's covered up by so many layers. Your job is just to stay here and watch all those layers unfold. Just like the stone bench changes into something very soft and beautiful and warm and lovely. When you know the way that mind works, you know that restlessness, it's promising you sort of some happiness and peace. That's why you follow it. It never gives it to you. You give up the restlessness and you find what restlessness promised anyway. Peace, happiness, joy, nimittas, jhanas, enlightenment, right in this very moment. So restlessness is always again thinking that somewhere else you'll find happiness. Stay where you are. Yeah, it's a tough stone bench to be on when you start, but it changes if you're still. And the last of those hindrances is doubt. What Ajahn Brahm says, is it really any good? Does he really know what he's talking about? How can he know what he's talking about? How can this method work when he's already admitted some of you have been coming back every 6 months for so many years? This must be a hopeless method. Because if it really did work, you come here, get jhanas, be enlightened, you wouldn't need to come back even twice or three times. Though people have all these doubts, is this the right method or that the right method? Am I doing it correctly? Or is it possible for someone like me to become enlightened? So we have all these doubts. And of course, those doubts, they just create restlessness and thinking. The way to overcome doubts is the simile which I gave of the mist on top of the mountain when I was a student. I used to spend many of my vacations in Scotland. I like peaceful places. I was a meditator, so I'd go up there and meditate for days on end. But one day I decided to go for this walk up the top of this mountain. And it was with the warden of the youth hostel. You know, he lived in the area. He knew what he was doing. So we walked up this mountain together and got to the top and said, oh, it's really nice. Sat down and said, oh, you know, there's another mountain over there. I'm going to walk on that one. You want to come with me? He said, oh, no. No, you can go by yourself. When I got to the top of the other mountain, it was just so quick. A cloud just descended from the sky and the whole top of the mountain was enveloped in impenetrable mist. You could only see maybe a couple of feet in front of you. He never realized just how dangerous that was. That warden should have known better than let me go alone. So there I was on top of the mountain, enveloped in mist, not knowing which way I was going to go. I thought I had a sense of direction. So I aimed for where I thought the hostel was. And I was walking, it was almost scared me because about 1 foot in front of me, I saw this vertical drop, a really big cliff. I could just see down through the mist, you know, down the bottom there. And if I had been not mindful, I'd have fallen over and killed myself for sure. It was a really big cliff. Later on, when I looked at the map, I'd actually been going 180 degrees in the opposite direction I thought I was going in. Because you can tell by the map where that cliff was. And so I turned around and realized I was in a dangerous situation. Couldn't see more than a couple of feet in front of me, totally lost. And then insight came, because I found a little stream, a little brook. And I was smart enough to know water always flows downhill. So all I need to do is to follow that brook, follow that water, and I'll be going down, 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 down. And I knew when you get down far enough, you're underneath the cloud. There's no more mist, and you can see where you are. Of course, that's what I did, and it was perfectly successful. Followed that little brook down, and it was still very dense. And then suddenly it got less dense, and a few meters in front, then you were under the cloud, and you can see the scenery. You can get your directions. You knew where you were. So I'd get my way home. And I use that simile. That's how you overcome doubt. Doubt is like a mist. You can't see the way. Yeah, you may believe Ajahn Brahm, you may believe some other Ajahn, some other teacher, what you should be doing, Vipassana, Samatha, this method, that method, should I be trying or should I be letting go? What the heck should I be doing? But that doubt is like a mist. You find a stream which is going down, 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 down. You know you're going in the right direction. So if your mind is becoming more peaceful, if the mindfulness is becoming more clear, there's more happiness and relaxation happening, you're going in the right direction. More sense of peace, more happiness, more contentment. That sign you're going in the right direction. That's the same as the river going down, 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 down. Just follow that. Follow that peace. Follow that contentment. Follow that increase of clarity. And you know, sooner or later, you'll be under that mist of doubt. And you'll be able to see your surroundings quite clearly. Ah, I don't need to sort of believe I have faith anymore. I can actually see the whole journey. And that's actually what happens. So use the guidelines of becoming more peaceful, more content, more happy, less angry, less needing of things, and you know you're going in the right direction. You feel you are actually making progress. You're following the stream which is going downhill. You're following the path which is leading to greater and greater peace, happiness, and clarity. And that's all you can do. And that actually works. And it gives you something which you know, I don't need to sort of waste too much time on doubting. I'm getting a little bit more peaceful, a little bit more clear, more happy. It must be going in the right direction. But if you're becoming more tense and more irritable, and the happiness is disappearing and disappearing, you're going in the wrong direction. Change your course. Do something different. And that's the way you can overcome doubt. So those are the five main hindrances. And there was always subsidiary hindrances. Like think. And of course, why do we think so much? And again, thinking is a part of restlessness. It can also be ill will and wanting, but mostly restlessness. But understand that because most thinking is a form of restlessness, and all restlessness comes because you're not content where you are. All thinking is not a sign of wisdom. Don't ever assume that if you think a lot, you're going to understand Dhamma. People have tried that for eons, and they just got themselves screwed up in their head and written Abhidhamma. So, stop all that thinking stuff. Instead, just make the mind peaceful. Never assume with all these concepts and ideas you're going to get any close to the truth. In silence, that's where you become face to face, nose to nose with the truth. Thinking just takes you further away. So, don't value thinking. As I said, the Buddha describes thinking was like a young man or young girl going out at night, dressed up in their finest suits and dresses, made up, just been to hairdresser, and someone puts on a garland of dead dog carcasses around their neck. That's straight from the word of the Buddha. And he said you'd be disgusted if you knew what you were doing, putting all these thoughts around your beautiful mind. And they are like dead things, thoughts. Dead ideas, old concepts. So the Buddha was quite fierce in the way he regarded this thinking as an obstacle to meditation. So don't delight in those thoughts. And don't assume that those thoughts are going to solve your problems. They create more problems, as many of you know by now. So taking the value away from the thoughts and putting it in the opposite, valuing peace. Because your mind, its very nature, will be to incline to what it finds most valuable. If the silence is more valuable, if you truly know in your guts that silence is important, then thoughts won't have a chance. But most of you still assume that thinking is valuable and going to get you somewhere, which is why you keep indulging in it. because you want to. You take away this value, see it's just so much yak, 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 totally, mostly meaningless. Then you find the thinking won't have a chance to establish itself in you. So remember, what you take as most valuable is what will remain in your mind. So do a PR job. Praise silence and take away all the value from thinking. And then silence will be there for you. And all the thinking will just vanish. That's the hindrance of thinking, trying to get that one away. And the last of the hindrances I'm going to mention today is impatience. 3 days have gone already. How far have you got? You're probably even worse than when you started, worse than when you begin. You've gone backwards. Ah, what am I going to do? The days are going, only 6 days left. What am I going to tell my husband when I get back? What am I going to tell my sister, my brother? Ah. They asked me, how was your meditation? Well, it was sort of all right, which means a total waste of time, total failure. You blew it, you stuffed up. So be patient. 6 days is 144 hours. That's 8,640 minutes, is that right? It's almost like 500,000 seconds. And only 1 second is all you need to get jhana. So you've got 500,000 chances, heaps of time. So just take a break, have a cup of tea, have a rest. There's many millions, many hundreds of thousands of seconds left. So be patient. Wait in the moment and forget about the future. Who knows what's going to happen next? Who cares what's going to happen next? It's not my job to worry about what's going to happen next. My whole job is just to be with what's happening now. So present moment awareness, full on. And then patience is natural. Two hindrances, number one and number two, just gone. Silence when you don't value the thinking. Restlessness, you're just content to be here. Dullness, it just goes by itself towards the end of this retreat, middle of the retreat. The more you relax, the less you fight, the less dullness you'll have. And as for doubt, you'll see that this path is leading in the right direction. You're not quite sure, but it's making you more peaceful, more happy, more content. It must be right. It is right. It will be right. All right? Thank you for listening. Very good. Any questions on the hindrances? Going. Oh, I can't do this. Gone. I've lost my gong. Gone. Okay, so now we have interviews for those who want interviews. For those who've been thinking too much, you can come and have interviews. For those of you who want some peace and quiet, just sit down, close your eyes, make peace, be kind, be gentle. Just see what happens. And overcome those hindrances and you have a wonderful time. So there's nothing, no problems anymore. You know what to do, you know what not to do. So just follow instructions. And you'll all have jhana by lunchtime. Ah, oh, come on!